Hello, this is Sean Kennedy. I'm the Editor-in-Chief of the American Journal of Nursing, and I'm very pleased to be speaking today with Dr. Kathleen Murphy. Kathleen is an Associate Professor at the University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston School of Nursing, and the former Health Services Director for the Milwaukee Public Schools. I got that right, didn't I, Kathleen?
You did.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And Kathleen is the author of an article in the September issue. The article is Emergency Anaphylaxis at School. And in the article, Kathleen describes an emergency anaphylaxis response protocol so that nurses, school nurses, would have available to them epinephrine auto-injectors for children who perhaps had not been identified as having life-threatening allergies. So we're very pleased to be able to bring this article to you. It offers some very specific information, and Kathleen has put in the protocols that the Milwaukee schools use. So those of you who are interested in starting such a protocol have some guidance here. But Kathleen, tell us a little bit about how this all came about.
Well, over a number of years, Sean, we had had, specifically I think within the last 5 years before we started the protocol, we had had two children who died in Milwaukee Public Schools as a result of an anaphylactic reaction. And these were children who had not previously been identified as having anaphylaxis. So it was a great concern in that aspect that there are children out there who have their declarative reaction at school, and so there's nothing in place to help them because no one knows they have an allergy. And then in addition, we had a number of children who did have identified allergens and were at risk for anaphylaxis, but for a number of reasons, they did not have epinephrine auto-injectors at school.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the points you bring out in the article is that I think you said about a quarter of children with undiagnosed food allergy will have their first or declarative reaction in school, which was startling to me. That seems like such a high number and very scary.
It does seem like a high number, doesn't it? When you begin to think of a school district population, for instance, in Milwaukee Public Schools at the time, I believe our student enrollment was about 90,000 children. Well, 25% of that is a huge number. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, that's the maximum end of it. But even one child is, of course, one too many.
Right.
If it's your child.
Right. And I imagine it's the aftermath of such an event in school, both for the children and the teachers and the nurse and everyone who was involved, the feelings of what could we have done, or wasn't there something we could have done or should have done, especially when one knows that, you know, it's an anaphylactic reaction and if you only had an EpiPen.
Exactly.
Feeling, yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, it precisely what you're saying, nurses found themselves in the situation where here's a child who hasn't been diagnosed and trying to make that judgment for him or herself whether he or she is going to take somebody else's pen and use it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've identified the symptoms even though the child doesn't have a diagnosis. That really leaves the nurse in a terribly vulnerable position. Mm-hmm. And like all good nurses, they want to do something.
Right.
Anything to help. And having some clarity around what those symptoms are, being able to identify them, and more importantly, having an action that can be taken without that fear or worry about should I or shouldn't I, really takes that whole piece out of the equation and makes it a much safer environment, both for the child and the nurse.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, when you began to develop the protocol, I see in the article you talk about the school physician who was totally on board, but there was also some legislation that's been out there. There was the School Access to Emergency Epinephrine Act you mentioned, which was signed into law in November of 2013. But only 5 states require their school districts to have these stock auto injectors, which seemed shocking to me. Especially after I'm sure many schools have had incidences of children who've had anaphylaxis and perhaps had a death because there wasn't anything available.
And there are many schools that even despite lack of legislation, still have such a protocol. In fact, the Milwaukee Public Schools protocol predated the legislation in the state. And basically what the legislation does is protects both nurses and unlicensed staff against prosecution from civil liability if they recognize and implement such a protocol. But the protocol, of course, has to be in place and has to be signed by a physician. And I think sometimes it does come down to, I wonder if that number of five being so small is a result of this sort of pushback against unfunded mandates, because as you know, this is not an inexpensive proposition. I'd say the return on investment is quite good when you look at what the alternative is, but the initial cash outlay, I think, puts some people aback.
Right, and I would imagine, of course, today that's, you know, economics is and what people are spending in schools and on school nurses and school nurse programs, everyone's looking at everything so carefully. And many states don't even require a school nurse in every school, from what I understand. So
that's true.
Know, so it, to me, that would be even more of an impetus to have a protocol where unlicensed personnel, you know, are protected and educated in emergency protocols. But yet that doesn't seem to be so.
Yeah, it's very interesting. For instance, if you look at the side where children who have a known allergy and the potential for anaphylaxis, they're typically required by federal education law to have an individualized health plan.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, their symptoms are already identified. They're very specific. Unlicensed staff are trained in that event to be able to recognize that specific child's symptoms, and there's typically an auto injector in place to use for that child. This whole gray area comes in when there's not somebody licensed in the school to make a determination about, is this really anaphylaxis that I'm seeing?
Now, when you started working on the protocol, because there wasn't the legislative support when you started this, did you encounter any pushback?
Really, the pushback was, again, relative to the cost. The fact that we'd had two deaths really, I think, helped move this forward. Nobody wanted to see that happen again. Everyone wanted to be able to protect students as much as possible. So it was really just in terms of getting the medical advisor on board, which, as I said in the article, she was indeed, crafting a protocol, which we actually did in conjunction with our local asthma and allergy clinic at Children's Hospital. We worked closely with them. And then, you know, training the nurses to recognize, because many of the anaphylaxis symptomatology is not, you know, people think very often about the throat closing and difficulty breathing. There are many children whose anaphylaxis is GI, and when they're reacting, they're vomiting. So, but, you know, those aren't typical things that you think about. So educating people about what the signs and the symptoms are and being able to sort of put the whole puzzle together quickly and then act quickly.
It was, in your experience, were teachers and perhaps coaches and other people who were are involved or were trained in recognizing anaphylaxis, are they reluctant to be involved or to have this kind of responsibility, or perhaps did they welcome the education feeling that they had it anyway and this would only help them?
I think it's probably a little bit of both, Sean. For children who already have their allergies identified, that training is part of that individualized health plan. But I will just tell you anecdotally, as the mother of a child with severe allergies to all nuts, I will never forget the day the school, and he happened to be in a school without a school nurse, the day the school secretary called me and told me what was happening with his reaction, and they had given him diphenhydramine or Benadryl, and I was running to my car and screaming over the cell phone, give him the EpiPen, give him the EpiPen, you know, but they are reluctant to do so, and I understand why. You know, it's a large bore needle, it's life-saving, and yet there's always a fear or a question, what if it's not really that bad, and I go ahead and give it. Right. And the counsel that I always give is, if it's not really anaphylaxis, the worst that's probably going to happen is a really rapid heartbeat, and they're going to feel anxious and nervous for a while. Mm-hmm. If it is anaphylaxis, you've performed something life saving.
Right.
So there's no downside in that scenario.
Yeah. Yeah. And your son had the EpiPen prescribed.
Yes, and had it at school.
Yeah. So I can imagine the confusion when it's a child who hasn't been diagnosed, and this is a declarative reaction, and people aren't aware that, you know, the child is having an anaphylaxis reaction. I can imagine just how reluctant people are in that situation.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And I can give you an example of in Milwaukee Public Schools, one of the first times we used the protocol was a special needs child who was not communicative. And clearly there was something wrong, and within very short order, the nurse was able to ascertain the child had been stung by a bee.
Oh, wow.
This was a child who had no known history of allergy, mm-hmm. wasn't able to communicate what was happening, but between talking with the teacher and figuring out the environment and everything else, they finally realized what had happened and gave the EpiPen, and it was life-saving.
Awesome. And you point out in the article, was this the example right after the protocol happened?
Yes.
Because you do talk about how within a few days of the protocol being passed that there was an occasion where it worked.
Yes.
So if there was any doubt about that year, the budget allocation, that resolved it, I'm sure.
And to date, I think there have been about 9. So this protocol has been in place for about 5 years.
And at least one a year.
Yeah.
And more than one a year.
More than one a year,
wow.
Yeah. And it's interesting because even, you know, with the protocol, the training, and nurses are still afraid that they may not recognize it. And so every time somebody has a situation where they have to implement the protocol, we have them share that at the next staff meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's encouraging to the other nurses, and oftentimes the story will be, I wasn't sure, but then I just had to trust myself, and I realized this is what it was, and I moved forward. It's sort of the theme of most of the stories.
Mm-hmm. Now, is there, we know that when people don't implement something that they've learned on an ongoing basis, they tend to, you know, it tends to get become a little bit vague, or if it's a skill, it's not quite up to par. For example, CPR, people have to be recertified every year in CPR. And even that is questionably whether once a year training is enough. Now, fortunately, the EpiPen doesn't require a lot of skill in the sense you just, you know, punch it into a thigh. But in terms of the recognition of signs and symptoms, is there an ongoing or a repetition of the education at some point?
There is. There's sort of back-to-school training that happens every fall, and typically nurses are on campus for a week before students come. And some of that is obviously getting ready for special needs students or creating new individualized health plans, getting rooms stocked and that sort of thing. But part of what happens is moving through our emergency protocols. So our as you mentioned, CPR and AED, those protocols and doing drills on that is part of the back-to-school training, as is reinforcing of the EpiPen protocol and passing out the EpiPens.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I know I was briefly on the National Association of School Nurses website, and they, of course, have a position paper supporting such a protocols. Are there many states that, or many school districts like Milwaukee that have gone and instituted protocols even, well, now they have the law that will protect people, but have kind of just moved ahead with the need without waiting for legislation? Is that the norm?
I think that is the norm. The biggest barrier that I think people face is, especially when it relates to nurses, as long as the nurse is practicing within his or her scope of practice and there's an order for it, mm-hmm. everything is okay. But it really does become a financial issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is possible to get epinephrine via vial and syringe, but let's face it, in a when seconds count and it's a low incidence but high criticality event, it's just not feasible. It makes the most sense to have an auto-injector.
Right.
And, of course, the nature of the auto-injector is it expires in 12 to 14 months, so that's an ongoing expense. But when you think about other ongoing expenses that we don't question, when children need insulin every day, we don't say, well, we've got to give that every day and we can't really afford to do it, so we're not going to. We just need to begin to think about it differently. It's a life-saving measure. It's not unlike, it's hard to go into a school now that doesn't have a defibrillator. And as little as 10 years ago, there were hardly any in schools. We just need to reframe how we think about it, that it's emergent life-saving treatment.
And as you said, we wouldn't not provide insulin when that's needed, so the argument doesn't seem to hold water if that's the argument.
Right.
And especially when you think of, not that I'm against football or sports in school by any means. My three sons played sports all through school, but when sometimes one thinks of the budgets for some of these other activities and yet you're balancing budgets against a child's life, it seems to be a no-brainer in many of these school districts. And it's probably more important because there was a trend that school districts, in looking to save money, one of the ways they were doing it was to not have a school nurse.
Right.
And it seems that such a protocol becomes even more important than when there is a school nurse, perhaps, who's being split between, two or three buildings or high school, middle school, elementary school. It seems that this should be something we're seeing more of.
Yeah, and I think it points to a larger issue, which is bigger than what we're talking about here with the EpiPens, but that school nurses typically come out of education budgets, not Department of Health budgets or Division of Health budgets. So part of what school nurses get caught in is no one would disagree that a school nurse is good for school children and good for their health and safety, but whose dime is it?
Yeah, right.
Which bucket does it come out of? So you're right, when it comes out of an education bucket and they have other parameters they have to meet, it's one of the things that goes first. But I will tell you, it is one of the things that comes back first when there's an untoward outcome.
I bet. So to wind up, if there's a nurse listening out there and wants to really look at implementing such a protocol, what's the first thing you would tell this person?
The first thing I would do, because remember, it's going to be a money equation, no matter, at some point the money is going to be an issue. So what you really need to do is arm yourself with data. It's good to have a story to illustrate the data. Hopefully you don't have a bad outcome like we did, which was one of the things that drove us. But if you do, of course, tell that story. But you want to have data about what the incidence is of allergic children in your school or in your school district. And a lot of schools have electronic health records now, so that should be fairly easy to access. You want to be able to sort of identify what that population is and thus what the likelihood is of someone either having an allergy identified and not having their EpiPen at school, or not even having an allergy identified and being subject to an anaphylactic reaction. And then you want to get people on board. You want to talk with your lead administrator, whether it's your principal or the superintendent. You can't go it alone. This is one of those it takes a village projects, because people need to be on board. Once you've done that, you want to make sure that you've done some costing out of what the EpiPens or if whatever auto-injector device you use, what that cost would be. You need to figure out how many you'd need per building, and then present that information. Make sure you have the medical and pediatric community on board, whether it's pediatric asthma and immunology, your medical advisor for the district. Make sure you have an order. And then, of course, you need to educate the staff, which we talked about a little bit earlier, the signs and symptoms of anaphylaxis, how you intervene, when you intervene. Keep the protocol as simple as possible. remember, in an emergent situation, there shouldn't be 85 steps. There should be 3 steps.
Right. Right.
1, 2, 3. It should be that easy for people to implement. And then you want to have a way to keep track of how often you implement it and what the outcome is. Mm-hmm. Even when it's a successful outcome, people have to be debriefed. It's a big deal when it happens. There's a lot of adrenaline. There's a lot of chaos in the moment. You need to debrief after every event, successful or not, so that you can improve upon the process for the next time.
Well, that's great advice. And Kathleen, thank you so much again for taking the time to speak with us and for the article. I'm sure it'll get a lot of readership.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.